I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran. And this is Radio versus the Martians.
Well, the thing with Michael Jackson, though, too, is that we start with him being the biggest star in the world, and then we go through the troubles where there's a lot of allegations being thrown around, and then he dies, and then everyone sort of rediscovers how great his music is, and then the allegations come back with new allegations, and then we're back to going, oh, yeah, that stuff. And I don't even know where we stand right now, but there was, like, a documentary that came out.
Yeah.
It's... There is
the weird thing where both angles makes sense from a point of view of like us as people that don't know what happened. One is overzealous parents looking to find a way to extract money from one of the richest people probably in their zip code, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's the other, which is like, yeah, people who are sufficiently rich can do almost whatever they want and get away with it. So, those two things are both likely things that could have happened in that. And clearly some things must have happened for it to have started.
Both of these things can happen at the same time. But I mean, the fact is that he was a very famous person. And it goes the other way, too, which is that you want your kid hanging out with a famous person. And you're so blinded by fame that you let things happen to your fucking kid. I mean, that does happen.
I mean, people do that with
the shit that happens to kid actors is fucking horrifying. You hear the stuff from, like, Corey Feldman.
Right.
And it wasn't until Me Too that people actually decided that they wanted to start listening to him, because they first started talking to him when the first series of allegations against Michael Jackson came out. And he said, no, Michael Jackson didn't do anything to me, but I'm happy to name names. And they're like, yeah, well, those names aren't Michael Jackson, so we don't give a shit. And imagine what that fucking does to you, man.
Now that I'm forewarned, I would never allow my children to be in the entertainment industry ever.
No.
Just full stop, ever. Simply because, like, is there a high likelihood that someone is going to try to sexually take advantage of them? Yes.
Yeah.
Is there a high likelihood that if you're a woman or an attractive man or anyone for that matter, maybe not a dog, I don't know, Hollywood, I don't know your tastes. Is there a high likelihood someone's going to try to sexually assault you? Yes. But at least when you're an adult, you could have the ability to say no.
Well, that's,
and that, slap and run and, you know.
But even when you're an adult, there's people who have power over you and you want your career. This is how the Harvey Weinstein stuff happens. But, I mean, you have a situation like, and I forget this guy's name, but there's been a lot of people sort of talking about this and this coming out in the recent years. There was like a producer who was in charge of all of the live action Nickelodeon shows in like the 90s.
Hmm.
And a lot of young girls who were frequently sexualized. And, you know, he was hiring these girls who were like 17 and stuff and putting them on these shows. And the dude is a fucking creep. And there's a lot of stories and a lot of innuendo about this guy. And I think there was some kind of, you know, fallout to that. But, you know, it's a perfect job for a fucking predator. Because people are not only letting their guard down to put their kid near you, but they'll leave their kid alone with you. I mean, if you're like a fucking monster, that's your job. And if you're powerful and you have the power to make and break careers, that's how you get the Weinsteins of the world. Because, you know, when you have somebody who wields that much power, you get something. I mean, and this is the thing with the people who are like a true on, full on, you know, Jeremy Savills,
Gary Glitters,
yeah. The Bill Cosbys, is that you have basically an open secret that you know this stuff. You may only know it as a whisper, or you may have, like, I know a guy who knows a guy who has a sister that auditioned with somebody.
Sure.
But that stuff does get around. It doesn't, there's no way that nobody heard anything about it. The problem is a question of who, where the power lies. And if you're somebody who doesn't have power and you do want to have a career in a certain industry, it means probably biting your lip. And this is what happens every time the first allegation comes out against a powerful person, which is that you know, there's a long silence and then everyone just dogpiles the person throwing the allegations at, and somebody else who was a victim of that same person is watching this on news and goes, oh, fuck. Fuck. You know, I know this person is telling the truth because that shit happened to me. And it, and you know, as each person comes forward, another person gets the strength to come forward because at least you got strength in numbers at that point.
Yeah.
And it more, the more that stuff that comes out, the more likely people are to believe you.
I mean, in the case of someone like, I don't know, Roger Ailes or someone who he looks like that weird goblin hacker from Blade 2. You know what I'm talking about? He's like, he kind of just looks like a disgusting creature, like and obviously what he chose to do with his life and his power makes him even more despicable. So you don't have, you're like, okay, I can believe it. I'm sure he hired blonde, buxom blonde women and sexually assaulted them and or harassed them and created a culture of sexual harassment. I'm sure he did.
It turns out people who run a far right propaganda machine don't respect women. Who would have thought?
The other thing is like a lot of this is faceless. I was reading something around Me Too about how maybe one of the biggest untapped troves it would be like the restaurant industry, where it would be like, of course you're not going to know who these people are. Unlike television actors and directors and writers and producers, these people aren't on the red carpet or whatever. They're just like going around the country and around the world trying to be the best they can. And of course, there's like the power dynamic there too. So I have to imagine that basically any industry has this particular problem.
I think every industry has this problem.
Well, every industry where there's money and there's power to be wielded over people, right?
Yeah.
I think it is perhaps a different story. The only reason why it's different to us is that we know the names and faces of the people. And it might also be the other side of it might be is that a lot of attractive people tend to gravitate towards the TV and movie industry because people who are very attractive tend to succeed.
Yeah. And then also those are the people who get cast and, you know, those are the, you know, powerful people will use that, you know, your Roger Ailes, your Bill Cosby's. And Bill Cosby even has another thing that, Jeremy Savile has, mm-hmm. which is this reputation as like a humanitarian.
Yeah.
That I am this great man.
Good cover.
Yeah. It's
a good cover.
It is a good cover, but it's also one that makes people want to call you a liar. This is the same thing that like the Catholic Church hid behind, which is the, oh my God, don't you know all the work these people do for the poor? It's like, well, the bottom line is there's no amount of soup kitchens that make it worth you doing truly terrible acts to innocent people. And it doesn't matter what good things or how many, you know, scholarships Bill Cosby has given out. The dude was a fucking criminal. And I have to admit that when that whole thing went down, and because it was crazy because Bill Cosby was like everyone's American surrogate dad.
Yeah.
That he was basically, he was kind of like having a TV stepdad.
Not only that, but he was one of the people that was in the forefront of that late 80s, early 90s, idea that the color, you know, the very utopian idea that the color boundary could be erased. Like if we're all sharing the same culture and having the same role models and like have a view into people who lived in a different part of the country.
I mean, it was a breakthrough for, you know, African-American actors. It was the biggest show on television.
But I mean, it was, if you'd have done it in any other decade, it wouldn't have had the audience that it had, and it wouldn't have had the number of children, you know, seeing a show that has successful black dad and black mom as doctors and lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's powerful. And
it
so
is, yeah.
That, of course, is what made the fall so hard.
That's
obviously
the thing is, again, he was everyone's dad.
Yeah.
And when he was convicted, I was honestly shocked. I didn't know what I expected until that moment. But I was like, oh my God, he's actually going to jail? And in that moment, I realized that in my gut, I expected him to get away with it. That I genuinely expect powerful people who commit crimes to get away with it. And I guess it's just that cynic in me where I'm just like, you just like, oh, of course. Yeah, he's going to go live in his big mansion and maybe do a comedy special that a bunch of, you know, old boomers who are, you know, la 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 will watch and right. cheer him on and just go, oh, those people are just a bunch of lying whores or whatever. And you just, you know, you expect somebody like that to sort of have their little Louis C.K. bubble that they get to live in, sure. where there you'll always find people who will kiss your ass and refuse to acknowledge that you're a horrible person.
You mean like everyone who supports Zimmerman? Is that George Zimmerman?
I don't think there's a lot of people left who support George Zimmerman.
I mean, how many times, this tells you something about someone's personality, is how many times do you think you can keep going back to the well to get financial support for murdering a black teenager, but Jesus. He's still trying.
The fucking evil, man. Jesus. This is, you know, it's like...
I mean, it is probably the most impactful thing he will ever have done with his life, and so... Like a true cynic, he is still trying to milk it for all its worth.
And this is, again, another example of the far right will grab some figure and hold them up as a hero, and it always backfires. they create their little martyr celebrity, and it's like, you give them enough fucking screen time, and they'll show you what a monster they are. This happened with George Zimmerman. It's just like, you know, it's like, well, I think he's a racist who killed a teenager, and then you're like... Oh, hey, look, he's showing you also beats his wife, and he's right. also a fucking racist who is, like, painting these Confederate flags to raise money for this gun store that refuses to do business with Muslims, and you're just like, fuck, guy. It's like, he wants to...
Those are all things in the plus column for... I mean, it's the Paula Deen thing, is that if that's how you're going to retreat, you could live off the racist money, right? Is that there is a fallback position. It's just like Louis C.K. There's a fallback position to just like cynical, like terrible white racists who hate everything younger than them and who are not interested in, like, you know, I don't know, listening to people who might have been assaulted by him or whatever. They're yeah, like, he's fine. I'll buy his album. I'll watch his movie or whatever. I'll go to see his show.
Yeah, but it's like this guy is doing everything he can. It's like Walter White, where, you know, it's like the show is going, hey, this is the bad guy. And then he goes, no, I'm really the bad guy. Look what I just did. I just let that woman choke to death. And you're like, no, dude, I'm really the bad guy. I poisoned a child. Do you get it now? Right. And then people are like, I don't know. I think Walter White's still the hero of this story. And that's what it's like with fucking George Zimmerman. What does this guy have to do? Because it's like, unless he like poisons the Gotham City water supply, I really don't know what it's going to take. Because every time he shows up in the news, it's like, oh yeah, remember that guy you made a fucking celebrity out of? Who fucking sold the gun that he committed murder with for like over $100,000.
It's just the case that lynch culture is still popular in this country. It's clearly still popular
fucking
in this country.
Monster this yeah. guy is. And it's like the same thing. Cliven Bundy, another right-wing celebrity that was built up, that again, that you give them enough time in front of a camera, they will out themselves. They will say something and you're like, oh yeah. And then Fox News just pretended they never existed. It's like, okay, under the rug with that. And that's the thing I kind of get with that bombshell movie is, yeah, bullies and awful people can also be victims. None of that should have happened to someone like Gretchen Carlson or Megyn Kelly. Yeah,
sure.
But Megyn Kelly's a fucking racist. Remember when sure. she was on TV insisting that Santa was a white guy? Like, getting really heated about it, and you're just like, oh, yeah. I guess I read somewhere that's going to be in the movie, and I'm like, oh, thank you. Thank you, movie. Don't let this person get built up as this. It's just, I like having this nice complicated image. You know, racists and bullies can also be victims. And it's like, this doesn't make anything Roger Ailes did okay. And, you know, I don't feel bad about that guy being dead.
You know, I got to give it to John Lithgow. He goes from playing Winston Churchill to playing Roger Ailes in such a hilarious shift. Yeah, but he could do it.
Well, he's a racist either way. But... There you go.
One's an inspiring racist, historical racist, and the other is just a greedy troll of a human being racist.
Yeah, so this is the thing you said before about, you know, Roger Ailes kind of looking like a monster, but does this happen because we know what he is? And I've said this before about when you see a picture of a serial killer and you know that it's a serial yeah. killer, you see like John Wayne Gacy or what is his name? The Green River Killer.
Bundy?
No, Ted Bundy was a different guy. Ted Bundy was, I guess, the handsome serial killer. Oh. I mean, Zac Efron played him in a movie.
That's true.
Zac Efron is not playing John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy would be probably played by, he was played by that guy who played Francis in Pee-wee's Big Adventure in a movie. But you know that guy who, he plays, you know, in the Tonya Harding story, that friend who thinks he's like a fucking spy and hits her in the leg with hits Nancy Kerrigan in the leg with a lead pipe.
Yes.
That actor who plays him, he's going to be playing Richard Jewell.
Yep. Yep.
That guy would be a really good John Wayne Gacy.
I can see that.
He was also in Black Klansman. So he's usually there to play sort of a villainous stooge. He's really good at that. A sort of a self-serious guy who's kind of a loser. That's kind of the vibe they're kind of getting with him. And it's, I gotta say, it's kind of inspired
casting.
Yeah,
that's a hell of a niche for an actor.
It is, but it's a niche that you can always fill. It's the kind that'll always be in a movie. It's kind of like in Aliens, the Paul Reiser role.
Oh my God.
I don't know how that didn't define his career. It must have taken a lot of effort, but to play this sort of nice on the surface corporate douchebag who will turn on you and be a coward. Paul Reiser was amazing in Aliens, and I don't know why he didn't play a bunch of middle management assholes for the rest of his career.
And just chalk it up to how good James Cameron is to finding an actor and then to giving them the space to be that kind of character, the memorable character.
But yeah, it's kind of weird how this stuff does define everything that you do, that everything that you play just goes back to that. It's like... you know, Tommy Lee Jones after Men in Black.
Sure.
That he's always going to be Men in Black character.
You could argue Fugitive was the start of that character.
Yeah, that sort of like casually...
Before I lose the thread here, because I'm going to lose it eventually, there was, I think, was it Skyfall where the villain was Javier Bardem?
Yes.
So that was a weird moment where, and this is sort of talking about the way we equate ugliness with evil, and I felt like it was a weird thing because it was the first time that the Broccoli universe, the Broccoli Empire, decided that the villain would be the main villain would be an out gay guy, because he tries to hit on, he does a very subtle pass to James Bond at a certain point.
Oh yeah.
But they also alternatively needed to make him ugly, so he, in a weird way, as they made him ugly because he was an aggressive gay guy, which is a little, I don't know how to put it.
But at the same time,
but then they also made him ugly because he had like a disfigured face or something.
He has a disfigured face.
And I'm like, why does he
need a cheek implant that he wears because he bit into like a poison pill that went bad.
Right.
And it didn't let him kill himself.
But why, like, the idea of being like, can't they just be ugly by their actions? Or,
you know, when he puts a cheek implant in, he's still Javier Bardem. He's doing pretty well. I mean, when he puts that thing back, like sort of false teeth bridge that goes into a sort of a cheek implant,
right.
he's Javier Bardem. I'm pretty sure he does not have trouble. But what I kind of like in that scene is that they don't play gay panic in it. That's the part that I really love, is that he's got James Bond tied to a chair and is questioning him, and he just kind of slowly starts unbuttoning James Bond's shirt. And he's like, oh, I bet you're wondering about your training now. What are the rules for this? How are you supposed to react or something? He's kind of being a little flirty, and James Bond says, who says it's my first time? And he kind of laughs at James Bond's joke. And there was actually a joke on the James Bonding podcast about this, and they were saying, let's just say for a moment that James Bond is not joking, and that James Bond has fooled around. They're like, what male character from the Bond series has James Bond slept with? And they both simultaneously said Tiger Tanaka from You Only Live Twice. Right, and I was like, yeah, it was Tiger Tanaka.
Hey, you know, he has to go undercover sometimes, and not just undercovers with a female sometimes.
But yeah, I mean, James Bond is just kind of throwing it in all directions. But yeah, he's, I mean, him and Tiger Tanaka were in a bathtub together.
This is true.
They were joking, but it's a little flirty. And they have sort of a shared, they're both spies, they're both kind of men of the world.
Does it? But does it depend on your...
They're both rabid misogynists.
Your assessment of James Bond's character, his character traits, does it depend, is it contiguous with the actor who plays him, or is each actor who plays him all James Bond, and so something that happened to George Lazenby also happened to Roger Moore's character?
Only if they want it to. The thing with James Bond continuity is it's a fucking mess.
Yes,
and
it is.
You know,
that guy's been been working for like 60 years now. It's pretty impressive.
You know, the only way that it could really work is, I know that there's a lot of fans that talk about the James Bond is just a code name thing. The new movie may kind of fuck that up, but because it seems that James Bond is his real name, that he goes off and has retired at the end of Spectre.
Right.
And this woman has taken in his job as 007, but if she doesn't take on the name James Bond or a similar name, it kills the theory.
That's true. So, well, they just say in the trailer she's a 00 agent, but they don't say the number, do they?
But they've said in the preview material that she's the new 007.
I see.
So if the name James Bond or Jane Bond or whatever the equivalent of, I don't know if there's there's another, like a female name that goes from agent to agent too. But the fan theory was that James Bond is a code name and that it just comes with the 007.
Right.
And that each one of these guys is a different person and it sort of explains it. But there's also things that throw that out the window. Like at the beginning of, I think there's one of the Roger Moore movies at the beginning where I think it's For Your Eyes Only, but I could be wrong, where you see Roger Moore lay flowers on the grave of his dead wife, Tracy.
Oh, from the Lazenby one.
Yeah. But it kind of is weird. And there's also the line at the beginning of
Living Daylights?
No, the Lazenby one. Why am I figuring her? On Her Majesty's Secret Service, where the line, of course, is a wink at the audience, where he says at the very beginning, "This never happened to the other fellow." Which makes no sense.
No.
If there's,
that was, you know, as problematic as you know, capital P problematic of the idea of changing him around was, that kind of broke it.
Yeah.
If they had just not said it, I think there wouldn't have been that. Maybe Lazenby wasn't as charismatic. It's hard to follow.
Yeah, well, he wasn't
John Connery, but I think there was a weird way in which they were trying to make a joke out of it, but I think it ended up breaking it in a way that they couldn't recover,
which was
probably part of why Lazenby didn't come back.
Well, he quit.
Oh, did he?
I didn't know that. That's my favorite James Bond movie is On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Lazenby is still not my favorite Bond. Hmm. I think he's really good at the action stuff, but he's not as relaxed with the acting or the charisma. But I think that, for instance, that Diana Rigg and Telly Savalas are so good that I think they cover for him.
Yes.
But the action part of it, like the fight scenes he does, are actually really good. He was an Australian model who basically, through power of personality and kind of forcing himself on the producers, got himself the job of James Bond, just as Sean Connery is quitting. Sean Connery hated being James Bond at the end. He hated that he was basically doing a new movie where he was traveling all over the world, doing all this promotional shit, heavily physical all the time, and it wore him out. He didn't feel he was getting paid enough for all the money that these movies were making. Mm. And so he got out of there. Lazenby did one movie, and then he was kind of getting into sort of counterculture hippie stuff. And his producer, his agent, told him that, well, you know what? This peace and love thing is coming. This James Bond thing is passe. You need to get out of that and get into other things. So he quit. He kind of turned on it and said that this is too establishment. Nobody wants James Bond. And that is the worst piece of advice that an agent has ever given a client. But Lazenby just decided not to come back. Like, he showed up at the premiere of the movie with his beard, and they were like, "What the fuck, dude? You don't look like James Bond." So they basically had to run a truckload of money over to Sean Connery's house to get him to come back for Diamonds Are Forever. But this idea of it being a code word, it makes more sense, because the idea of the end of On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Lazenby's Bond gets married, and she's immediately murdered in a drive-by shooting by Blofeld and his hench lady. I forget what her name is.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that he would quit, and Sean Connery is called back into service. Then he leaves. It's Roger Moore for a while. The question of, they are all the same character. There's technically the same continuity, but it doesn't really make a lot of sense, because you have a scene in GoldenEye where Judi Dench is taking over as the new M. And the idea is that Bond is established, and she kind of gives him a talking down where you're just like a misogynist dinosaur, and that we don't need agents like you in the new, you know, MI6. But then also she's there at the beginning of his career in the first Daniel Craig movie. So she's played, and it's technically a reboot, but I love that they don't give a fuck about continuity because Judi Dench is awesome and they brought her back.
Yeah.
My favorite M. I could watch scenes where Judi Dench just gives people a talking down for almost ever because she just makes it go like, oh, damn. She just chews people out. But it makes it look classy, too.
It's true.
Yeah, so is she there at the beginning of his career as sort of his mentor, or is she coming in and sort of taking over? See, that makes sense if they're two different Bonds.
Right.
But, you know, I think the thing that gets to the heart of it is who the fuck cares?
Right. And well, I mean, because you can't compare a James Bond, a Bond movie, a Roger Moore movie from the 70s to something from the teens.
Yeah.
And being like, why? These cannot be the same person.
Yeah, it's a different thing. Like, for instance, the Cold War isn't a thing anymore. So you can't do a story where the villain is trying to kick off a nuclear war between the Soviet Union, which doesn't exist anymore, and the United States. It just doesn't happen. But I mean, you know, it's obviously the 60s in some scenes. Like, there's some Bond movies where I'm sure having a cell phone would have totally derailed the plot.
Right, right.
But, you know, whatever. I think the attitude to have is that it doesn't really matter that much. We shouldn't get caught up in continuity quibbles because it doesn't fit together. There's evidence that it's the same dude, and there's evidence that it's not, and it doesn't really matter, which is why, you know, they've kind of did a soft reboot with Daniel Craig, and who fucking cares?
Right. I don't know. There was a weird... I've only seen Spectre once, but there was a weird thing that I think that they ended up changing in the editing that was a decision made, because you remember Blofeld captures James Bond and says, I'm going to strap you in this chair, and I've got this little drill machine, and this drill machine is going to basically remove your memory, your idea. You're going to live the rest of your life remembering anyone around you. And he does it. He gets, like, the drill goes in his head one time, and then James Bond gets out of it and escapes. And it's not spoken of. And then the next time you see Blofeld, he's captured James Bond in the basement of the old MI6 building, I think, and they have, like, hand-drawn lithographed pictures of people in his life, of faces in his life, as him sort of, I guess, facing what his legacy is, essentially. And I was like, what the fuck? This doesn't... Did he lose his... Because they don't say it. It actually looks like Daniel Craig's acting might be playing it, so all the people he's running into, he's sort of scared, and he's like, I don't know who you are, but I have to...
But he's faking it.
But he's faking it. And then they have this scene where Blofeld's like, he's like rubbing his nose in it, like, look at all these people. Do you remember this face? No, you don't remember this face. And then when he beats Blofeld at the end, they're at the bridge, at one of the bridges over London, and then he sees the love interest. And then there's another shot of the moment where it's like, does James Bond know who this actually is? And they don't say it out loud. And I'm like, I really do think that they had an out for the movie, which was Daniel Craig doesn't come back for Bond after this. Mm-hmm. That the end to his Daniel Craig is that he is... They filmed an ending where it's like, I don't know who I am, so I can't be James Bond anymore. You know, Idris Elba as James Bond in the next movie comes in the credits or something like that.
Yeah, we need to get on that.
And they didn't. Yeah, well, he already said he's too old. But, like, this is one of those things where I was like, I caught it. I haven't seen it again. And everyone else that I've asked this about, they'd be like, huh, I didn't pick that up. And I'm like, it seems like a plot point that was right in front of your face, that just the editing and the dialogue that they put on screen does not elucidate, you know.
I don't know, it's kind of weird because
it did have a fun Dave Bautista heavy character
that
in it,
was
though.
A lot of fun.
Yeah,
I love the idea that he never says anything and he just has these silver, like, metal fingernails on his thumb that he's, like, putting people's eyes out with, and his only line of dialogue is just shit. And I just think that's
love Dave Bautista.
I love He's Dave great. Bautista too. I think that he is, for all the pro wrestlers turned actors, had one of the most interesting careers. I mean, you look at, like, John Cena. John Cena is trying to branch out and do more comedy, but they really want to cast him as, like, a military dude in almost everything. And I think you have to probably assert a lot of your oomph to try to steer away from doing the obvious
thing. He can't do that forever, though. I mean, if you can do it in your 20s and your 30s, and if you have good genes. You could probably still do it into your mid-40s, but you know, at a certain point in time, he can't play a story about an Afghanistan veteran or an Afghanistan soldier in Afghanistan in the 20s, you know, in the aughts.
Yeah,
he can't. He's just going to get so old that he'll, you know. But I think John Cena's funny. I think Dave Bautista's...
He's had a much more interesting career, though.
But I think his affect, the perfect marriage of having his Drax character and his particular affect are just like, that was some gold. It rarely happens that an actor gets that, especially if they start off not as a professional actor and move into acting from something else.
Yeah.
Rarely happens that good.
Well, it's also because his characters have always been a little different from what you expect. That right. Dave Bautista looks like a monster, but they give him roles where he's kind of understated in some ways or shows vulnerability or he's funny. Like, for instance, he appears at the very beginning of Blade Runner 2049, and he has a sort of very quiet, understated role. And I like that a lot. He's also in Hotel Artemis. I don't know if you saw that one.
Didn't see Hotel Artemis, no.
It's good. I like it. It's not an amazing movie, but it's a really fun movie with a lot of actors I like. That his character is sort of the security guy for this hospital for criminals. And the character that Jodie Foster plays is sort of like the head doctor. And she has kind of an agoraphobia where she will not go outside. She can't handle going outside because it gives her these horrible panic attacks. And Dave Bautista's character is sort of like her orderly, but also the kind of muscle. And he knows that she has these panic attacks, and he's always kind of coming up with ways to sort of help her. And he's like, hey, did you listen to the tapes I got you? Those will really help. And there's something just very sweet about him. He's very protective, but he's very gentle. That he will snap a dude's fucking neck, but there's just this gentility that he has towards her that is just very endearing, and it never feels like put upon. It doesn't feel like it's this left turn. It's never played for laughs, but he's just this very sweet man who cares for somebody he knows is vulnerable.
Right.
And
that's impressive.
Yeah, I like Dave Bautista a lot. And then you have Drax, and Drax is fucking hilarious. Yeah. Drax is almost like a parody of a certain kind of like vengeance driven, you know, like it's like if you were making fun of what is the character from God of War?
Oh, yeah. Not Porthos. What am I thinking?
Kratos.
Kratos, yeah.
Kratos. It's like if you're making fun of that character, the sort of vengeance driven badass who's attacking everything and never wears a shirt. what I love is it just those kind of characters are hilarious in a lot of ways. That it's the way I've kind of described the Guardians of the Galaxy is that the Guardians of the Galaxy movies feel the most like a Dungeons and Dragons game that I've played. Where if you look at the people playing these characters, there's an obvious image that they're trying to put out, but then there's the way that they actually play it in the game that kind of undermines, because you want to be Batman, but you're not really Batman. Drax, every Dungeons and Dragons game I've ever played has had a Drax in the group of the guy who wants to be the dark, serious guy, but he ends up being a little bit of the butt of jokes and ends up being a lot funnier than he wants the character to be.
Right.
Through these sorts of moments. That opening scene of Guardians 2, where they've been hired by the queen of this planet to protect these batteries from a monster, that is a straight-up D&D game. And they're all kind of fighting amongst themselves. They never really come up with a coherent plan, and then they just luck through it. I have played that game so many fucking times that it really feels. There's like somebody who's kind of goofing off, who's basically playing Groot. Right. And having fun with it. And there's everyone, various levels of seriousness. But Guardians of the Galaxy feels like a role-playing game. There's something that's just very familiar and fun about it.
And it almost begs you to be like eating potato chips and drinking pop while you're watching it too.
Yeah.
Which is also how I associate D&D.
It's a Mountain Dew sort of movie.
Yeah. Stuber was good too. It was that was the Kumail Nanjiani vehicle with him as the cop. I don't know if you saw that one.
I saw the trailers for it. Was it good?
It was the plot of it is exactly what you would expect.
Yeah.
But I think Kumail Nanjiani ends up being almost the best part of everything that he's in. He was the only good thing about Men in Black International. His little weird alien character.
He's a little alien guy.
He looks like a chess piece. Is like the only funny or interesting part about the movie. And in this, the setup, the through line for The through line for Dave Bautista's character in Stuber is that he's a hard as nails, badass police detective who doesn't let, you know, he's a loose cannon, except on this day he got his eyes dilated so he can't see. And of course the criminal that he's been tracking for a while has finally reappeared. And so he commandeers the Uber, which is driven by Kumail Nanjiani. And it's really fucking funny. It's hilarious. It has every beat that you would imagine in a sort of buddy cop movie, and also the fish out of water thing. But I think the way that Bautista plays that weakness in his character of basically being blind the whole time is really fucking funny.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah,
that is fun. I that's what I like about Bautista, is that he plays this obvious badass character, but he'll always have some element that undermines it. There's always something that is funny, or there's something that is vulnerable, or there's something that is silly.
I don't know. Is Bautista our next nominee, our newest nominee for the Arnold Schwarzenegger follow-up, the next Schwarzenegger?
I don't know.
Because I know we said The Rock for Dwayne Johnson.
Yeah,
for
Dwayne
a
Johnson
while.
Really is, through especially the Fast and Furious movie, hitting a lot of the same buttons that Arnold did. But I feel like Dave Bautista has a potential for something even better. I think that he gets to be a really interesting, nuanced action star. I guess there's a little elements like in, you see with Harrison Ford at his best and Bruce Willis at his best before they both became sort of mumbly sleepwalking guys in movies. When they would try back in the 80s and stuff, there would be a vulnerability. Like, nobody gets their ass kicked better than Harrison Ford.
Right.
And there's bits in like Die Hard where Bruce Willis looks terrified. Terrified and beat up in a way that a lot of action stars like Arnold would never allow themselves to look. And, you know, Harrison Ford will get punched in the face and he'll do this thing in like an old movie, like an Indiana Jones movie, where he'll look dazed and freaked out while he's getting punched. Like, oh, shit, I got to run. And those little moments just make a situation both funnier and more harrowing than they would have been otherwise. And I kind of love that. Like, in Blade Runner, when he's running away from Roy Batty, he's like, oh, fuck. Yes. He looks terrified. I mean, he really stands no chance. And there's a question of how good he is at his job. I mean, he told Ryan Gosling, I had your job. I was good at it. But you're like, were you really? Were you really?
He's like, you just didn't see those 5 years before.
You shot two women in the back and then the last guy let you go. So are you really?
Well, Dave Bautista, I have not seen it, but the second Escape Plan movie, he basically is filled in for Arnold Schwarzenegger's spot. It's still Stallone as the lead character playing Ray Breslin or whatever it is, and Dave Bautista is the second bill. So he's replaced Arnold Schwarzenegger literally in that movie, in that series.
Interesting.
But I mean, I don't know. He how long was it before Arnold had a really funny comedy? Although I can't say that, because he was genuinely funny and interesting in Pumping Iron.
Yeah.
Which was probably the first time that, if anyone saw Arnold Schwarzenegger, it would probably have been that.
I'm trying to remember who he was. You said genuinely funny, because I mean, Hercules in New York is a comedy.
Yeah, I don't think it's genuinely funny. Like, I think its byproduct is that it's absurd, and the funniness comes from Arnold staying, not from
I mean, he's in The Villain, which I still haven't seen.
Yeah,
I don't either. It's a comedy, but
yeah.
Twins is, I'd say, the moment where he's like legitimately really funny.
And that's 87 or 88.
88, I think.
And that's still like, you know, 5-6 years after Conan and Terminator. So it really did take him a while to get to the point where he's saying, well, my range as an actor is not just what you would give a professional wrestler. Because all of Arnold's early movies are what you would give a professional wrestler.
Yeah.
Heavy, standing in an office somewhere, or, you know, like a good bodybuilder. Or
like a good professional wrestler is somebody who can command an audience and not just be a muscle guy. There's a lot of muscle guys. I mean, I love Sven Ole Thorsen, but Sven Ole Thorsen didn't become a big star.
No.
He just became a friend of Arnold who he would frequently kill.
No, there's no way, unless it was a Swedish movie, I suppose, but there's no way that you could ever have a Sven Ole Thorsen-led movie.
No.
It's impossible.
Sven is the guy you bring in as muscle, or you put a monster suit on him, or you have Arnold fight him. which is how a lot of movies used Arnold at first,
right?
Before he really got that stuff going. There's a handful of people who just have that spark of charisma where they can talk, they can be funny, they can make people want to listen to them, and they can make people care about them. Arnold has it, John Cena has it, The Rock has it, Dave Bautista has it. And then there are people who just don't. I mean, you know, some people just don't have that spark, but they're just very physically impressive. And those are the people that get, like, henchman roles.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
Would Richard Kiel be included in that?
Richard Kiel?
Kiel.
I think he's got a certain physical charisma to him. I mean, he does a lot of nonverbal acting in the two Bond movies that he's in.
That wasn't the same actor who played Lurch on the Addams Family TV series, was
no,
it?
No.
Because there's always been a stable of guys that clearly have some, like, pituitary thing that make them just, like, monstrously tall.
Yeah.
And so they become a monstrous kind of actor. I know Ham in Next Generation is one of those actors.
Yeah, he's like a really tall dude.
There's always, I'm sure in Hollywood, there are at least one of those guys who, when you need to do like a rip of Boris Karloff's Frankenstein's monster, you'd be like, well, he's on the Rolodex, get that guy.
Yeah, like I forget the actor is, he played the Predator, but there's a certain number of like 7 foot tall guys that you can bring in to do physical roles who aren't necessarily like actors that you would put behind the camera.
I think Doug Jones is that guy now.
Doug Jones is also pretty tall, but
yeah
Doug
he's,
Jones
he's
also
not, he's not he couldn't play Jaws unless he probably had some makeup prosthetics to make him look taller, but he can do that.
Yeah, that's his specialty.
He could make his body move differently, even if it meant that he was having to play a character that was a foot taller than he was.
But Doug Jones is the king of prosthetics. If you're going to turn somebody into a very elaborate prosthetic monster, Doug Jones is your dude. I mean, he's like, he is to that what Andy Serkis is to motion capture.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, he has played a fishman twice in two different movies for Guillermo del Toro. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of amazing. I mean, he has these sort of amazing performances. I believe he's on Star Trek Discovery as Saru.
He plays probably the most interesting character so far in the whole
thing.
That
is amazing makeup, too. Yeah. That's probably the best Star Trek makeup that I have ever seen is on the character of Saru.
It is finally the case where, kind of teased in the animated series, where you're like, wait a minute, we're in Star Trek universe, so if you didn't have budgetary concerns, you could make someone a gelatinous cube walking around on the bridge of the Enterprise, but they don't. And, you know, you have like, what is the name of the three-armed ensign from this animated series?
Oh, is it Eriks?
Yeah, that's right. You got it. Eriks.
Yeah.
I always wanted them, now that they're in the era when it's just like, they could easily just have, whenever they have a one shot or a wide shot, they could just put a third arm in. Just have one of his,
that would be
his
cool,
species walking around somewhere. But yeah, Doug Jones and his character of Saru is really like, they're like, oh yeah, we can actually do aliens that look amazing and are sufficiently alien, but then also let them have heart. Because he's also good because he's a good actor. The character is relatable. The character reinforces some of the things that we, as the fan, I won't speak for the fandom, that I like about sort of Star Trek's ideals. Because he exemplifies the Starfleet's ideals in terms of its universality and its plurality. And it's also, Doug Jones is also just a very, very good actor. Like a really good actor to be able to sell it to. Radio vs. the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Valverde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music is written and performed by James Wetzel. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobiah Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
I don't know where I came from exactly. First thing I remember is flickering, adrift in the cosmos, utterly and entirely alone. Over millions of years, I learned to control the molecules around me. I grew smarter and stronger. And I continued building from there, layer by layer, the very planet you walk on now. Whoa. But I wanted more. I desired meaning. There must be some life out there in the universe, besides just me, I thought. And so I set myself to task with finding it. I created what I imagined biological life to be like, down to the most minute detail.
Did you make a penis?
Dude.
What is wrong with you?
If he's a planet, how could he make a baby with your mother? He would smush her.
I don't need to hear how my parents.
Why? My father would tell the story of impregnating my mother every winter solstice.
That's disgusting.
It was beautiful. You Earthers have hang-ups.
Yes, Drax. I got a penis.
Ha! Thank you.
It's not half bad.